This is a summary about some of my work that I did during my PhD and some of the offshoot projects that had been going on. And this is essentially to provide a flavor how you can intertwine machine learning along with some foundations from your favorite problem, whether that's quantum physics or whether that's quantum field theory. And by intertwining them together, there is a chance that you can get better uncertainty quantification and better interpretability in the cases where you apply machine learning for physics problems. To that end, this is the topic that
And
I'm
indeed,
going to
just
introduce.
before we start, I just want to make sure we're recording here.
Yeah, it is being recorded. I'm very sure of that. And I can
Okay.
get the recording later on as well if you want.
Okay, sorry to interrupt.
No,
Thanks.
worries, no worries. I'm glad that you checked. So to that end, let me introduce this topic, neural network field theory, which was based on a correspondence between neural network output ensembles and field theories on Euclidean background. Finding connections between them just showed us that before including these optimization techniques, learning algorithms that people frequently use in machine learning, even before that, we could get field distributions out of neural networks. And by that, we were one step closer to neural networks giving us field theories at initialization. That means before you have defined a loss function, before you have taken into account these numerical errors into account. The scalar and Grossman, these terms here are the two facets that I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about scalar field theories or scalar valued output ensembles coming out of neural networks and how those correspond to scalar field theories, and then Grossman neural networks, how you define Grossman valued field distributions out of neural networks, such that it leads to better error control in future when you are trying to compute something for field theories on lattice using machine learning, for example. So this is based on a number of papers here. Let me start with defining the term, and then I will go ahead step by step. First, neural network field theory. It's an unusual term. Generally, neural networks are just black boxes. You feed in some number, it gives you out some number. Now, whatever it generates depends on the configurations inside the black box. There are many knobs inside the black box that you can tune, and these knobs have different names. Some of them are called parameters, which are associated with some stochastic distributions, generally with well-defined probability distributions. And some other knobs are called hyperparameters. These are generally numbers that you choose. And by this choice of different stochastic distributions for some knobs, some number choices for some other knobs, you get to decide what kind of, to some extent, you get to decide what kind of number this box is going to generate. This is more or less how generic neural networks work. Now, machine learning is one step ahead. Generally, the knobs inside the black box remain as they are, but then once you involve some kind of optimization technique, these knobs inside start rotating. So learning algorithm, defining a loss function, lets you tune these knobs in different ways. They change. And because these knobs keep changing, the numbers these black boxes generate, they change as well. In general, the numbers that you generate will be such that whatever loss function that you have defined, it goes down and down and down, up to some numerical precision level. But there's no way to ensure that the loss actually absolutely goes to zero. And whatever number you are producing at the end of training, quote unquote, that is exactly representing the system, the physical system that you are interested in. So at best, up to the numerical precision, you can put your faith in machine learning that it is doing its job. It is representing some wave function, some quantum state, some quantum field theory configuration, or something else, the best it can. But there is no way to quantify what is still they represent or if there is a way to get further better results. So this is one of the limitations of modern machine learning techniques. And of course, there is fantastic research going on in machine learning industry about this uncertainty quantification, robustness, interpretability. But of course, they are not as concerned about these as physicists are, as people in lattice field theory community are, or as people in quantum matter community are. So that's where we wanted to define field theories by constraining these knobs inside the architectures before going on to defining loss function. So we decided to put in the term field theory to define the output ensembles and their statistical distributions for an initialized neural network architecture where the knobs have not started rotating in response to some loss function and some learning algorithm. So first, everyone knows these days that neural networks are amazing. Sora came out a few days back. It's doing amazing jobs out there. There's DALL-E, there's ChatGPT, varieties of examples of transformers and diffusion models are doing magic. And they are doing magic because neural networks are universal approximators. These black boxes can give you any kind of number distributions, any kind of numerical outputs that you try to approximate. It has that power. And that power makes it useful for quantum systems and also quantum field theory. I'll stick to quantum field theory for the rest of my talk. So there's a well-known ongoing topic in lattice field theory community, machine learning applications to quantum field theory. And there is a structural similarity to those applications to quantum system where you define, say, systems with spins on different lattice sites. So in these cases, machine learning work pretty well because these are machine learning provides you a powerful approach to represent target field theories or target quantum state on a system of lattice. Of course, up to numerical precision, it works very well. So simply put, machine learning for quantum field theory are equivalently, if you go to quantum states, engineers the field theories or the quantum states using some kind of optimization algorithm and step-by-step minimization of loss. To get some better uncertainty quantification, we went back, and this is one of the approaches. In future, we hope there would be many such other approaches. We went back to the very beginning, where we defined this black box. So to define a black box that gives you a field theory, we had to identify the knobs inside the black box that gives you, say, symmetries of the action, that gives you a certain kind of interaction terms in the action, or that gives you a certain dynamic term in the action. And after defining what these knobs are, we set up some principles to constrain these so that these boxes would exactly represent some field theory that you like. So in this way, we are improving the robustness and interpretability, and we are starting with neural network architectures without involving learning algorithms for quantum field theories before we think about learning algorithm. I'll briefly discuss what happens when you include learning at the very end of my talk. That's another important and interesting aspect. So something that I discussed, I will talk now about how to open these black boxes, how to identify these knobs, and then what do we get in return. So first, a very brief summary about this whole topic where the black boxes give you field theory, and then how to construct action of these field theories and whether those are even useful for anybody caring about problems, say in lattice field theory. The third topic, how to do the reverse. If you have an action, is there a method or systematic approach to construct an architecture where you do not involve learning algorithm or loss functions, but rather you just define the knobs, define the choices of parameters and hyperparameters, and you get that action resulting out of that black box. And the fourth one is Grossman-valued neural network field theory, introduction to what that means, and then an architecture which gives you the free Dirac field theory at initialization. So the first one, based on these three existing works, it just tells you that one can write the output of a very generic neural network architecture as a normalized sum over the neurons in the last hidden layer. Now, this is a simple single hidden layer architecture. It looks like a feedforward network. It could be something much more convoluted. It could be the last layer of a transformer, which is the backbone of ChatGPT. It could be a CNN. It could be anything. But to define, in most generic architectures, to define the output, people just take anything that comes out of the last layer neurons and then sum them up. The summing is denoted by this index, which runs over the neurons. Neurons are just the nodes where the functions act on incoming data and gives you some kind of outgoing data. So these are called neurons. And this sum denotes these nodes or neurons in the last hidden layer. Question?
Oh, yeah, I think you are about to discuss. So what's the output? So first you have a phi.
Yeah, this is a great question. So the output phi In essence, it's any function, and how the function is composed depends on the choice of these knobs, the parameters, hyperparameters, number of hidden layers, activation functions inside these black boxes. The notation phi here denotes that I'm going to interpret the output as a field from this point on. But it, in essence, the structure of phi depends on the choice of the neural network initialization, but the arguments to this function are x, the same as the input data, which can be the training data, the test set data to the neural network architecture. As we built up this correspondence, we found a map that if you interpret the inputs as points from space or space-time, so you can choose Euclidean or you could choose a Lorentzian background, then these output functions become the equivalent elements of a field defined on these points. If you want to ask me more about this, I can come back to the after my talk.
So I just want to understand, yeah. There are two outputs in the output layer.
Yeah.
Is it different values of phi or observables? Because phi is a scalar, it's a number.
That's a great question. So I wanted to keep this generic. Phi in general denotes a scalar output, but because I'm going to talk about Grassmann's later on as well, this O1 and O2, these can be vectorized outputs. In fact, in machine learning, people often get vectorized outputs, and these indices 1, 2 will denote the elements in the vector. So if this was limited just to 1, then it would indeed be a scalar phi x. But if it was more than 1, then we are talking about something that's not a scalar valued output from field theoretic perspective.
More than a scalar field theory.
Yeah, right. In fact, that's how we are going to limit ourselves to scalar field theory or Grassmann valued field theory at initialization. Now, the essence here is that the black boxes have their own functional forms. And these functional forms would depend on your choice of parameter, hyperparameter, activation function, other details of the architectures. But once you choose what these details are, then at least as long as you do not incorporate training algorithms and do not start changing the knobs using training algorithms, as long as you keep these constraints fixed, then the neural network would always keep giving you some value of phi of x. And this value of phi of x would create a statistical distribution. This happens because the parameters inside the black box, they are samples from different kinds of statistical distributions. All of them may be sampled from a single statistical distribution, or you can choose every parameter to be drawn from a different distribution. And because of that, there is this stochasticity, and that stochasticity ensures that anytime you are getting, you are on your computer, you are getting an output for this function phi of x, it's giving you a different number. But all of those numbers themselves make a single functional distribution. It's a wrong way to state this. All of those numbers are coming due to the same sources of parameter distributions inside these black boxes. And this phi of x themselves, if you keep generating phi of x a number of times for fixed choices of x, you will get a functional distribution of a phi of x. So from path integral formalism, field theories of functional distributions, and then you connect the two bridges. Because of this bridge, it's very much possible to give a partition function interpretation for every neural network architecture. And then every neural network architecture would have a corresponding action. Now, this is a general setup. And in future, I hope to work with Roger along this for quantum states, quantum systems, but that's a different topic. But all I'm showing is that this is one of the ways to exploit field theoretic properties out of neural networks before you even incorporate a learning algorithm.
Quick question. So does the network structure network has any effect on the example of the
Oh, yes, absolutely. The structure of the network has a lot of effects on the output. Something, let me discuss the next parts, and if this is not clear, I'll come back. So this is how the structure of the network shows up in what kind of outputs are generated by the architecture. So because of this sum, if this HI, the neuron outputs, behave as independent random variables, then in the limit that this sum becomes a sum over infinite number, if n goes to infinity, this phi becomes a sum over infinite number of random variables, which are independent from each other. And this is just a structural thing about the neural network black box. But then central limit theorem from statistics governs that such a phi has to be a draw from some Gaussian distribution. From field theory perspective, that becomes a free scalar field theory. Now, if you consider different structures inside the architecture, and I'm just talking about something simple like the parameters and this hyperparameter, and I have not even touched anything about the activation functions or number of hidden layers. So if you change these constraints, if, say, let me go to the next page, if n is finite, the last hidden layers VD is what I'm talking about. So you can have a network which has 100 hidden layers. And up to 99th layer, you can have a low number of neurons, smaller layers, and then the final one can be asymptotically large, say 10,000, or close to being 1 million. And you have kept all the parameters IID. Even then, the previous constraint of central limit theorem works, phi would be a draw from a Gaussian distribution. But the final layers, width, as long as that becomes finite, and for practical real-life purpose, finite would mean 50 to 100 as the last hidden layer width. And if you choose the parameters, stochastic parameters in the black box to be dissimilar or statistically correlated, then phi, by violation of central limit theorem, becomes a draw from some non-Gaussian functional distribution. In field theoretic language, you are turning on field interactions in whatever is the action associated with this architecture. Now, how badly you define this architecture, as in how badly you choose your weight of the last hidden layer and parameter distributions, would in turn lead to action S, which is a non-perturbative one, or a weakly interacting one. Because the whole source of field interaction is central limit theorem. This is significantly different than how we have understood field interactions to actually arise in particle physics context. And there is another important point here, something I have not yet highlighted. Even when we are talking about, say, free field theory arising in this infinite width and IID independently, identically sampled neural network parameter distribution limit, this free theory has an operator, the Gaussian of free operator. And the structure of that operator would depend on what activation functions we have chosen, how many hidden layers we have. And same goes even if we are in this regime where the architecture corresponds to an interacting field theory. Because the interaction terms themselves would depend on also on these choices of activation functions, hidden layers, and other details, but in different ways. As in the quartic and sextic interaction term might have very different kind of dependence on these details of the architectures. There are a plethora of related works. Broadly classified, some of them are machine learning for lattice field theory, which is an overlapping field. And one whole section I do not even mention here is machine learning for quantum states, neural network quantum states. That has a structural similarity at this point, but not a direct connection yet. There are also plenty of work that explores machine learning from a statistical field theoretic perspective. In some cases, they actually bring in the Euclidean field theory version of quantum field theory. So when I say quantum field theory, I'm referring to the way quantum field theory has been formulated and has been used over the last 30 years in particle physics context, and I'm not so much going back to the way quantum field theory originated from statistical field theory. So these three different directions in this phase space denote three different ways of getting interaction terms in these actions of neural network architectures. So there are many combinations possible. All of these combinations would give you some kind of a neural network initialization. And that particular neural network architecture would have some specific action associated with it. And it is not a one-to-one map. In general, it is possible to have more than one architectures which have identical action, or it is also possible to have an architecture that is slightly different from another one, but their actions are going to be significantly different. So to summarize, it is a two-way street. We have found that architectures, once you open up these black boxes and start looking into what's inside, try playing with the stuffs inside, you get some notion that in turn you are going to induce some kind of changes with these actions. Then the question is, how can we control these changes? If we know the kind of changes we want in the action, how can we control the tuning of the knobs? And how can we also do the reverse? So it is understood that we can use the power of neural networks to do something for field theory, but in turn, in future, we also hope to see the reverse, that you take field theory techniques and try to explain what these tuning of the knobs or learning algorithms or different things mean. That's beyond the scope of my talk today, but something I'll briefly capture later on. So one question here. All of us here are fundamental physicists, which means at the end of the day, we would ask this question inevitably. These field theories are Euclidean and statistical. So if I care about quantum field theory for any problem, how do I get any benefits? So there's a clause there, and that clause is that the correlation functions that you get from these phis, they are going to be, of course, Euclidean correlators. But if all such correlators associated with an architecture satisfy Osterwalder-Schwader axioms, then this field theory that your neural network gives you at initialization has an analytic continuation to Lorentzian background, which means if you compute anything using this neural network, suppose you initialize this neural network on your computer and just compute the correlation function of phis by the method of statistical moments. You get an ensemble of the phi for 50,000 times and compute six-point function by statistical moment methods. What you're getting is an estimate for this field theory. And although this is Euclidean, in principle, you should be able to make the continuation to the same field theory on Lorentzian background. So such architectures, of course, it's going to be a subset of architectures. So from the space of all possible neural network architectures that are out in the market, only a section of them are going to correspond to quantum field theories, not all.
Can I ask you
Yeah.
In free scalar field theory that you presented here, the data points are just space-time points, right? And
exactly.
Space-time symmetries, they work for a single class. They have equivalent class of a single point because of, you know, translational symmetry and Lorentz symmetry, rotational symmetry, etc. So how we can train our network with a single data point?
This is a great question. So it's not exactly as single as a simple class. Because depending on what kind of activation functions that you choose, the free operator is going to be different. So the dynamic term is going to be different. And because it's different, every time you train the network, let me just skip a few slides and describe what I mean here. This is how the free action looks like. And this two-point function has the effects of the parameter distributions from the previous hidden layers, every parameter that goes on until the last hidden layer itself. So the moment you are training, all these parameter distributions at each of these nodes keeps shifting. And training changes all of them in independent ways. And because of this, generally after training, it's kind of difficult to get an analytic notion of what the new parameter distribution is, because something, everything started with Gaussian, something changed to hypergeometric, something changed to uniform, something changed to Bernoulli distribution, right? So because of this, when you start training, the ensemble of the phis would give you a very nice structure for this. But at the end of the training, this would have a very non-trivial structure. So this is how the two-point function keeps changing. Its inverse keeps changing, so the free action evolves over time. Let me go to the next section, which is for any given architecture, if we really want to explore the field theoretic properties, how can we even extract the actions at significant leading orders? And how do we even know that there's a way to stop at some order and get an effective action for this architecture? That's going to be the second part. So to do that, let's just recall this. I talked about the knobs inside the black box. And this black box defines a particular space, which I call parameter space. And then there is a set of numbers coming outside of the box, which have field theoretic interpretations. So this box, in the inside of the box, presents a dual framework for whatever is happening on the edge of the box. So let me define the parameter space. If you take anything such as symmetries of these field theories or say correlation functions of the field theories, there are always two ways of studying or investigating them. You can start with studying the knobs, the parameters, hyperparameters inside the box, and try to infer this information, correlation function symmetries, inside the box. And using that, you can depict what goes on in action S. Or you can do the reverse. You can study action, correlation function, if you know the action S directly. Now, given any generic neural network, you can at best say that all the parameters are IIT, or the last hidden layer is infinite, because you have been just given an initialized network on the computer. You can just see the code. But suppose you are not at a point where you are getting a free field theory out of this architecture, then you cannot figure out what's going to be the action exactly, or what is even the effective action closely approximating that architecture. In general, it is pretty hard. So to that end, there is a method that you can utilize to construct the effective action at leading orders. The way we do it is first start with getting the correlation functions of the output files as statistical moments using the distribution of the parameters throughout the network. This phi would depend on all the choices of activation functions, hidden layers, all such details. And in general, you should be able to integrate this. Of course, that is a separate question altogether. This correlation functions, in an ideal scenario, if you have a very large number of such phis in the ensemble, then this expectation value is the same as the correlation function. So this is one subtlety, that you have to get an ensemble of the output phi, which is pretty large in number. And only then the statistical distribution would be approximated by the path integral formalism. Now here, assuming that you have a very large enough ensemble for the neural network output phi, you have two different ways to study something as simple as correlation functions. Now this, or as a derivative of the partition function, if you want to deduce the correlators as derivative of partition functions, you need knowledge of the action. In this case, you don't know that. So just stick to this one and exploit these structures or the expressions that you get. So something that we showed, and something that also statistical physics community had previously deduced, that for neural network architectures, the moment you bring in path integral formalism, you can express the action associated with any architecture as a sum of free part and then many interaction terms. And the free part can be deduced as soon as you find out what the two-point function of the output ensemble is. As long as that is an invertible operator, you get the free action. And the interaction terms are little more non-trivial than that. So going to the interaction terms in general is not pretty straightforward. In statistical physics community, people have convoluted expression for these given in terms of the parameter distribution, activation functions, etc. Those in general cannot be recast into this expression that we know how interaction terms look like unless you do some kind of a massaging a set of steps in between. To do those steps, we introduced a new set of Feynman rules. And using that one, we could reconstruct each of these couplings using the connected part of these correlation functions. So in general, each of these couplings, GR, they are obtained as summation over many Feynman diagrams involving these connected correlators. In these Feynman diagrams, these connected parts of the correlators play the roles of internal vortices. And because there are many other connected correlation functions showing up in each coupling, if these connected correlators have some kind of implicit scaling, some of them would have more weightage towards that coupling versus some others would not. Just to demonstrate this point, we found out if the field interactions arise because of finite width of the architecture, while the knobs, the parameters, hyperparameters are IID, the connected parts of the correlation functions have a scaling that depends on the last hidden layer's weight. So in this case, a simplification happens. This is just the Feynman rules. In that particular case that I just talked about, a simplification happens. A particular order of connected correlator, which is the quartic order here, has leading order contribution to the same order coupling, which is the quartic coupling here. And all the other diagrams coming from higher order connected correlators gives subleading corrections. Now, if we go back to the other case where you are getting field interactions due to statistical correlation in the parameters or dissimilar parameters, also finite width, then generally the connected correlators have mixed n scaling, and you need to find more constraints to deduce the relevance of these couplings. As in the sextic may be, in some cases, more relevant than the quartic coupling, which is very counterintuitive. But it really depends on the structure of the neural network, and that gives you field theories that you would not usually expect to see. So let me just demonstrate a real-life example, a very simple single hidden layer architecture with a cosine activation function, and there are just three choices of parameters. Choose them as IID, but choose finite width for the last hidden layer, which is the single hidden layer here. In this particular case, this is an effective action for the architecture. This is the free part, and this is the leading order, the quartic interaction part. And of course, there would be higher order interaction terms, but those are suppressed by 1 over n squared. So if the last hidden layer width is, say, 100 or 150, then you can see that this term would scale as 1 over 150. This term would scale as just order 1 number. And this is scaling as 1 over 150 squared. So because of this, we can truncate the action associated with the architecture at a reasonable number. But of course, for smaller width, as in smaller last layer width architectures, one has to retain higher and higher number of more relevant terms to make sure that the summation, the truncation of the series makes sense. Let me quickly talk about a reverse engineering method. Now, that was interesting, but more interesting would be if given any example. So suppose you know that there's a particular field theory out there with certain interaction term, and you're trying to find a neural network architecture that would just directly give you that at initialization, as in you would not require the optimization algorithm. Such an approach would just let you compute the correlation functions of the field theory using that neural network directly and make the uncertainty quantification way better, because what happens here is you have a neural network, you generate ensemble of its outputs, use that to compute the correlation functions, you're directly computing correlation functions of the same corresponding field theory. So any kind of numerical uncertainty that happens here would be solely due to the numerical error or numerical precision level of the computer, and you can assure that the field distribution is coming right out of the architecture itself. The architecture is interpretable and more robust to represent this field theory. So this is a question about reverse engineering, and we found our method to be limited to the case when the action can be divided as a free plus some interaction term. So if the action is highly non-perturbative, something very non-trivial in structure, then this method does not work. But subject to this particular case, let me demonstrate what it is. So here I have denoted an operator O, which depends on the field phi, to represent the interaction. And you can understand that this is going to be just an easy interpolation of this method. If there are a higher number of interaction terms, one can just simply write more number of terms and keep repeating this method to get an architecture corresponding to the full action. So the way we get an architecture to represent this action is two steps. For this one case, two steps. If there are a higher number of interactions, one has to iterate the number of steps. So the first term is to get the action exactly corresponding to the free action. So free action means you have to get the output from a Gaussian distribution. You need the last hidden layer to be infinite or asymptotically large for real-life networks. The parameter throughout the network has to be sampled IID. G means Gaussian, that is corresponding to a free field theory. And then you have to also guess the number of hidden layers and what the activation functions should be for the two-point function. And in general, it is straightforward because the two-point function is expectation value, a product of two activation functions. So it's expectation value of rho I times rho j in general. So it is pretty straightforward to guess for most cases. Then after getting this, we have to generate the right interaction term. So for that reason, what we do here is this. Keep the last hidden layer still to be infinite width, but then induce the field interactions by deforming the parameter distributions, induce some statistical correlation between the parameters. So this was the previous parameter distribution, and now there is an extra exponent term, and this operator here depends on phi, which depends on all the parameters h. So now the resulting product is no longer statistically independent in each value of these parameters in H. So you have now broken down the IID assumption. You are going to get an output ensemble, which corresponds to an interacting field theory. And a few simple steps show that from the partition function perspective, it is effectively inserting this extra factor in the interaction term. So to summarize this method, you have a black box that gives you the free field, you get the free action. Using the free field and the parameter distribution for this free field, redefine a new convoluted parameter distribution. And as long as you keep other choices fixed, but just use this new parameter distribution, this combination together would give you a new action for this new architecture question.
May I ask, is it I can guess it's quite difficult to solve from this new probability function pH to get the norm set distributions.
This is a very good question. Yeah, very good question. And in general, it can be because you can redefine this parameter distribution. But then once you sample, you still have to make sure that the way you have redefined has to give you a non-trivial exponential factor here. Suppose you have defined O of phi, but that value is so large that this exponential is essentially leading to zero, then it does not make any sense. So that's one of the subtleties.
Yeah, I'm just curious, for example, for the lambda phi 4 or lambda phi cube. Mm-hmm. So is it being solved for this probability distribution, for the easy interaction?
So for phi 4, lambda phi 4, we have the structure for the resulting parameter distribution. And for lambda phi 3, one can similarly write it down. So the subtlety is about sampling from this new parameter distribution. But in general, getting the form of this new parameter distribution is not that difficult. This is the example related to lambda phi 4. So the free part and the interaction term. And if you go step by step, first you want to generate the free part. And the free part is easy because using a little bit of intuition, if you play with these neural networks, especially single hidden layer, one can see that up to some clever renormalization factor that I have in front, if you choose a cosine activation function, then the two-point function in the Fourier basis looks like this, exactly like this, exactly the inverse of this. But of course, one has to find out what the associated with parameter distributions are, which are these, which are all IIT. And then for this term, what we did was construct the original PDF. So you construct the original PDF, but then sandwich this extra factor. Now, if the value of phi is very large, the value of phi coming from the neural network is the free neural network, free field theoretic neural network is very large, then this exponential factor is just going to effectively reduce all the statistical correlation that you want to show up in this new probability distribution. But if you can take care of that, so that's a sampling problem that's still there. But once you take care of that, then you generate a new partition function where the new statistically correlated parameter distribution shows up. And in turn, this gives rise to this extra term in the action. Does this answer your question?
Yeah.
Now, why is this relevant for real-life lambda phi 4 theories? Two reasons. First, if you go back a few steps and check, then you will see that all the correlation functions, even including the effects of this term, they all satisfy Osterwalder correlation, Osterwalder-Schrader axioms, which means that the neural network corresponding to this particular action actually gives you a theory that has analytic continuation to Lorentzian background. And the second point is a theorem that I did not discuss. It basically depicts that all the global symmetries of the actions of any architecture arises due to the choice of symmetry invariances of the parameter distributions in the architecture. Of course, the action can have more symmetries. I'm only limiting myself to the global symmetries arising due to constraint of these knobs. But because of this, if you choose the parameters as they are, so you can see there's a rotational invariance, there's translation invariance in the way we have defined. I'm not going into the details, but once one follows that theorem, it is pretty easy to prove, like actually analytically prove, not numerically prove, analytically prove that this action itself is going to be Euclidean invariant. So the combination of Euclidean invariance and the correlation functions being reflection positive, Euclidean invariant, and they're also invariant under permutations and cluster decomposition, this lets you get a neural network corresponding exactly to this theory that you can initialize on your computer, get some calculations done, and move on with peace from uncertainty quantifications and robustness issues in generally people have to deal with.
So an activation function is for the final hidden layer, right?
Exactly.
Asking about the previous hidden layers.
This is a great question. So in this particular case, we chose only one single hidden layer, and that was cosine, because we had to get exactly this term. But if you choose many hidden layers and put cosine in the last one, this would not be as simple as this. There would be more effects coming from the activation functions of the previous hidden layers. So this was actually as simple as just taking the universal approximator property of a neural network. Because of that, we have an infinite bit neural network. And we also understood that if you truncate the width of this single layer network to be something finite, then the universal approximation property does not show up as well as it should. It's something that works in the infinite width limit from the definition. And because in that limit, the universal approximator property holds, you can get the full effect of this scalar FIFO theory, the lambda FIFO theory, show up even after the deforming the parameter distribution.
How did you come up with cosine? Just using experiments?
No. This was a clever intuition. So if you notice, here there is a term that looks like square root of bi square plus m square, and bi is a vector. Now, if you take product of two phis, then you get a term that's bi square plus m square, no square root, right? So that gives you a similarity with 1 over p square plus m square if you promote b to p. But to get to the scalar field theory two-point function, you also need the exponential term. You need e to the power ip x minus x1, or on Euclidean, you need e to the power minus px1 minus x2, right? That translation invariant factor. So we had to cleverly get that exponential factor from this two-point function. And cosine, or effectively, if one did it with sine, those can be written as sums over exponentials, right? And if you do this expectation value of a product of two phis, you can see that the e to the power something plus something, that very nicely actually shows up as e to the power p times x1 minus x2. So it took a little intuition, but once you see it, you cannot unsee it. All right. So I have 15 remaining minutes. Let me quickly give a flavor of the remaining topic, and then I can end on time. So the last one is Grossman neural network field theory. And this is related to the question that you asked about O1, O2, those levels that I had in the outputs. So in general, neural networks give you vector-valued outputs. You can limit that vector to be a single number and get a scalar field distribution out of it. But suppose you want to get something that behaves like Grossman. In the sense, it will, if it is a vector with four elements and it is behaving like Grossman, you expect the regular anti-commutations to hold and so on. So how do we constrain the knobs to get that? And if we can get that, then how can we get some fermionic field distribution? So these are some natural questions one would ask after seeing this whole presentation until here. Let me give you a flavor into that. So this is work in progress. So first, we defined a Grossman central limit theorem, which is simple. Define random variables, which have two different indices. One of them, this later one here, it behaves as an element in a Grossman space. And the first one, let's sum over these random variables to incorporate the usual central limit theorem. So there is a sum over these. The sum happens in the first index. And this sum lets you borrow the notion of sum over n random variables would become a Gaussian distribution in the limit n goes to infinity. This comes in directly because of this index. And the second index makes sure that each of these random variables are Grossman. So element-wise, you ensure or impose anti-commutation relation on them. And after that, you have to define their probability distribution such that these would behave like Grossman, yet there would be limits where they become Gaussian and some limits when they are non-Gaussian. So for simplicity, we assume the case when each of these random variables are mean-free. And after that, we impose the statistical similarity in each of the x's as well as the statistical independence in each of the x's. There is one caveat. Along the first index I, that's where you can impose all of these constraints freely. There is nothing barring anybody. But in the second index, in the Grossman index, one has to retain statistical correlation because this ensures that you get some non-zero elements in the two-point function once you compute the two-point function of this sum psi. Now, if you want to deduce a Gaussian distribution and non-Gaussian distribution, you want to retain some non-vanishing terms in that distribution, something that acts as the inverse of the two-point function or higher-order terms for a non-Gaussian distribution. And for that very reason, we had, along the Grossman axis, we had statistical correlation between these variables. And this is limited to a single statistical index. So keep the statistical index fixed, but induce statistical correlation between the elements along the Grassmann axis. And after that, one can simply show that each of the connected correlators of psi, which I denote by kappa, they depend on the connected correlators of each of these Grassmann variables up to some n scaling. And this n scaling makes sure that if r is greater than 2, all these connected correlators or cumulants will vanish as n goes to infinity. And in that limit, you get only the two-point function remaining, all higher-order connected correlation functions vanishing. That's a signature of Gaussian distribution. Now, borrowing that, we will now promote the neural network outputs to be a sum over neurons where each of the neurons give you Grassmann valued outputs. So now the neural network output has an index I. And this I would run from 1 to d. And this x are sampled from small d-dimensional Riemannian manifold. So there are two different indices, two different dimensions. One is associated with the input space. The other is associated with the output space. And I have switched the statistical index positioning with the Grassmann index. Now, once you do this trick, for a very simple network where the last layer has a linear structure, no matter what goes on in the other layers, as long as the last layer has an affine transformation, setting the bias to 0, you can write the contribution of the last layer neurons as some weight times a post-activation. Now, either of these can be Grassmann. The other one can be C number. Both of them cannot be C numbers, obviously, but both of them also cannot be Grassmanns, because then psi would not anti-commit with each other. So there are two different cases. And for simplicity and for depicting the Dirac fermionic case, I would stick to this particular limit. So that limit is pretty simple. The weights of the final layer, A, they are Grassmann variables. So everything that I talked about Grassmann central limit theorem, you impose the very same conditions on these parameters A. And once you do that, no matter what neurons you have chosen, no matter what post-activations you have chosen, everything in the architecture can be as it is. But just the final layer where it's being Grassmann valued lets you have these psis, which are drawn from a Grassmann valued field distribution. That field distribution is Gaussian as n goes to infinity, as long as the constraints on A are the IID constraints I have shown before. Now, you might ask, is this even a realistic parameter distribution? Can one actually initialize a network with this? The answer is yes. I'll give you an example right afterwards. So this is the crux of the story. You have to do some manipulations in the very final layer, weights and biases. Set bias to 0, turn on the weights as Grassmann numbers, and after that, you are getting a Grassmann field theory out of the neural network architecture at initialization. So then, if we can actually do that, then why don't we actually get some known fermionic field theory out of these Grassmann-valued neural networks by some manipulation? That should be pretty straightforward. And the answer is yes. So we wanted to do the simplest thing, free Dirac field theory at initialization from an architecture. There is a caveat here. These neural network field theories are defined on Euclidean background. And on Euclidean background, free Dirac theory, if you do a few number of steps starting from the propagator on Minkowski space, if you make the analytic continuation to Euclidean space, you would see that the expression that you get, it's not Hermitian. So in the Minkowski, the two-point function depends on the field and its Hermitian conjugate, but the same expression on the Euclidean space is not Hermitian. So something breaks down. So I cannot just start with a normal field psi like here. I cannot have this one coming out of a neural network and have that give me the free Dirac theory. So what can we do? If you investigate literature, there's actually a solution there. It's very interesting. There's a lot of subtlety that I loved. Introduce an auxiliary field psi, chi, which plays the role of psi bar. But psi and chi are not related via Hermitian conjugation to each other. So this guy over here is a new field altogether. And the two-point function on Euclidean depends on the new field and the old field. So psi and chi together gives you the two-point function, which has the structure in Fourier basis. So we have found at least the theoretical basis that if we are talking about a legit free Dirac theory on Euclidean background that the neural network can give, this has to be the action associated with the architecture. And there has to be 8 degrees of freedom if it is a 4-dimensional space. And the propagator has this structure. Now, this made us think that in the free scalar field theory case, we had 1 over p squared plus m squared, and we did some trick where we inserted a 1 over p squared plus m squared prefactor in the neural network output. We can do something similar here. So we did something similar here. The neural network architecture, whatever it is, gives us components which can be divided into 2 parts. And these 2 parts play the role of psi and chi. Psi has this structure. There are 3 different parameters, A, B, and C. And this is the prefactor which is associated with this. The other field, chi, has a different parameter, A. And this is necessary because I'm talking about Grassmann-valued parameters A in the final hidden layer. So these are playing the roles of the weights, and these are playing the roles of the post-activations. And you can consider that these prefactors, these operators, should be parts of the post-activations as well. So this operator R is actually this part going back. This is the two-point function that we wanted to get. And to get that, we have to make sure that we define an operator, which is, of course, invertible, that we made sure it looks like this. So it is general. It does not have to be limited to 4-dimensional input manifold for the neural network inputs. And then because we want a free theory, we had to bring in the constraints of Grassmann central limit theorem. So we have an infinite width neural network, IIT parameters along the statistical axis. The parameter distributions are straightforward, B and E, and it was pretty easy to notice what those would be. And this guy over here is Grassmannian. This looks like a Gaussian distribution, except all the diagonal elements vanish between A0 and A1, and only the off-diagonal elements retain. So this is realistic. You can actually initialize this network on your computer, and in turn, you will get a two-point function in the Fourier basis, which looks exactly like what we want. And you can invert this to show that the action associated with this architecture is this. So if you generate the outputs of this architecture many times and create a statistical ensemble and compute the 2.4-point, et cetera, 2.4-point functions, et cetera, you are getting the answers on Euclidean manifold. And then you have to go another step, impose spin statistics theorem on Euclidean space, and then talk about actual answers corresponding to Dirac theory on Lorentzian background. So that's an extra step. We have not yet gone there. This is something I wanted to present today. And let me summarize. Yeah?
A question like, how do you interpret this other view of the kind?
This is a very good question. So for neural network purpose, this is just part of the output of the neural network, right? And the neural network does not actually distinguish between psi and chi. So interpretability-wise, I would say that they have equal footing. But from physics interpretability point of view, one of them is auxiliary, as in it's just a ghost field corresponding to psi bar.
Are there complex value functions?
So far, no. This is the funny part, that none of these are complex valued. Oh, one quick comment. So if you're getting the inverse of this, so this is a matrix, and then get the inverse and the square root of that, there may be some complex eigenvalues there. We have checked in general there will be complex eigenvalues here. But just this, in general, the post-activation part is not going to be complex value. Yeah, that was definitely one of our concerns, that we wanted to have totally real valid outputs coming out of the neural network and still ensure that the Fermionic properties and Grassmannian properties would still hold. OK, let me summarize. So first, I inspired you guys to think about application of machine learning by opening up the black box. Open up the black box, identify the knobs, tune those knobs before involving optimization techniques. And once I did that, or we did that, many, many amazing collaborators along with me, we have seen that for field theory, it is possible to get free or interacting field theory depending on how you have constrained those knobs at initialization. Now, after you constrain those knobs, you wanted to ask a natural question, how do we make a sense out of the field distribution that comes out? And to that end, we had to develop a method that lets you deduce the action at sensible leading orders as a truncated series sum. And then we had to do the reverse. We had to take in an action written on paper and ask ourselves, how can we tune the knobs to generate that very action at initialization? And we found that certain kind of actions where the free and the interaction part could be segregated, we can retain infinite weight neural networks, but induce a parameter deformation by statistical correlation, and that gives you certain kind of interaction terms at initialization. So that's an exact representation, which means, in principle, zero errors associated with these kind of computations. So the example was lambda 5-4, scalar field theory. Then I went ahead and talked about how to get free and interacting Grossman-valued neural network field theories by violation of Grossman's central limit theorem. And as an example, I gave a very simple example, which was the Dirac Fermanic field theory, but on Euclidean background, that can be simulated by this architecture that I just presented. So one caveat is that this is useful for two reasons. First, if you're interested in field theory on lattice, you can use this technique, which lets you for easy actions or for known actions. It is, in principle, and we hope also for some say gauge theory and some other interacting interactions in Dirac field theory. We have considered the UCAR coupling, but for higher order interactions and as such, we do hope to get architectures which lets you exactly simulate that field theory at initialization. So then you have an architecture that represents exactly the field configuration that you want. It lets you escape a few steps of Monte Carlo or MCMC or HMC. So in some sense, this lets you sample a better network that you can utilize for bootstrapping some computations. And finally, some of our ongoing works in this particular direction is about finding a neural network that gives you two outputs or two components in the output that are related to each other by supersymmetry, and also a neural network that gives you gauge fields as outputs. Now, two important things that I did not have a chance to discuss, I'll briefly touch. So one of them is in an ongoing collaboration with Roger and a particle physicist at Triumph, is that we got interested to think about neural network outputs in this way. So it is possible to constrain the parameters and hyperparameters in such a way so that you can sample exactly a certain function or, say, a certain density. In principle, it is possible. This program was just an example. And we are borrowing that notion right now to investigate how to play with the inner structures of restricted Boltzmann machines, RBMs, to make sure that we can analytically predict what we are going to sample. So this is a hard question about sampling in RBMs, and we are working towards that. And the second interesting thing that I did not talk about is, in this particular program, what happens when you train the network? So in another ongoing collaboration, which involves a whole correspondence class between exact RG flows and Bayesian optimization schemes, we are connecting that to this one, and we found that, in fact, you take this ensemble of neural networks at initialization, you are getting some field theory, there's some action. Once you train it, your parameter distributions certainly change. But there are cases, such as starting with an infinite weight network with IIT parameters, there are ways to train it such that your parameter distributions would change but would still be close to IIT. There would be some statistical correlation, but it would be a sensible amount. It won't lead to a field theory at the training steps and at the final steps, which would be non-perturbative in nature. As in, at any training step, if you just take the neural network out of the training and generate its output many times and create an ensemble, then the action associated with that ensemble would still be related to the original action that you had by RG flow. So this is one of the interesting things. Then there is a way to understand machine learning from a renormalization group flow perspective, which is I'm not going into detail, but which is something people in machine learning community claim all the time. It's coarse graining, it's RG, but well, so that's all. Thank you so much. These are amazing collaborators, and Jim is my PhD advisor. And thank you everybody. I'm happy to take any questions. Also, if anyone is on Zoom, I cannot see the Zoom screen. Would be good. Please unmute yourself and ask as many questions as you want.
So for the case of Grassmannian, I assume it would be easier to consider massless Dirac field because they would be buying.
I know.
And then I assume it wouldn't, I mean, we do need to make a double within the number of Visa Freedom, right?
Yeah. That's something we definitely want to do. So there's one caveat there. You can definitely define wild fermions. But at the same time, if you're talking about wild fermions on Euclidean, you have to make sure that those make sense. Those are actually the analytic contribution of wild fermion on the Lorentzian background. And to do that, there are questions about spin statistics theorem. And this is something I'd be very happy to talk to people about, because this is a subject, the literature on this subject is not super clear out there. And what exactly happens to the spin statistics theorem once you make this continuation from Lorentzian to Euclidean for wild fermions? Yeah. In principle, one can define any kind of field theories on Euclidean background using these neural networks. But at the end of the day, they have to, I mean, for anybody interested in particle physics or condensed matter, some of them at least have to make some sense to actual field configurations on Lorentzian. Sorry? That's an amazing question. So it's not a project I work in, but Jim has a different collaboration with different people working on that direction. They are working to build conformal field theories on Euclidean background using these neural networks. So in principle, yes, if you want to see the implementation, I'm still waiting. Let's see. It'll probably take some time. So as you can guess, once you're trying to come up with principles that lets you deduce what knobs you have to tune inside these architectures to different kind of properties like conformal invariance, a certain kind of invariance. I was talking about global symmetries. I was not talking about conformal invariance, right? So it's a bit tricky. And if it was so simple, then machine learning community, some physicists, there are so many smart brains who are applying machine learning for field theory and lattice field theory on many applications in particle physics and condensed matter. Some of them would have definitely thought about this and solved it in real time. Most of the cases, it takes you a little bit of thinking out of the box. And I hope with more progress in machine learning, we'll have many scopes to see areas where, you know, we can play with the neural network architecture and see these kind of properties arising. I know, yeah. We definitely, from what I've heard in the particle physics side of my community background, so I'm kind of at the intersection, where people definitely want to see some applications of this technique for conformal bootstrapping using neural network and machine learning. Yeah.
So you said that you can approximate training by some RG. So like you were talking about conformal field theory just now. So you know that in certain dimensions you have interacting fixed points, that conformal fixed points. So you could potentially look at those via this RG flow. You should be able to use those.
That would be amazing. Yeah, that would.
Yeah.
I mean, so the thing is, we found that the connecting neural network field theories to RG is pretty straightforward. An example that I did not give today, of course, limitation, but we found that if you take just the architecture for the free scalar field theory, where you have p squared plus m squared in the Gaussian operator, an infinite width network, single heter layer. If you take that one and then train it by stochastic gradient descent with L2 loss, the effect that it induces on the parameter distribution actually leads to mass renormalization. Something that we are writing out right now, it's so interesting. So we have to yet see how general this is, whether this holds true for any kind of infinite width neural network where any kind of changes induced in the parameter distribution simply shows up as mass renormalization. My intuition says it should, but one has to see. And then so this was just a free theory. It stays very close to a free theory because of the training constraints, L2 loss, and SGD, which is why the effects induced by RG show up as mass renormalization. And then the question is, if you have a finite width network, even say IIT parameter distributions, then what would be the effects of the training? Would it just be mass renormalization? No, you should expect some higher order effects to also show up. What are those? Wilsonian RG, something else? I don't know the answer to that. But yeah, just in principle, it is possible once we figure these steps out gradually, it should be possible to see whether we can probe into a critical point in the RG, a critical flow that you expect to see in the phase space in the RG flow context just by using training algorithms. Yeah.
So I'm curious, what can be the potential application to the, for example, the community of field theory?
Yeah, this is an amazing question. So you are talking specifically about Ising model, right?
Scattering amplitudes.
Yeah. So we have so far, we absolutely clearly know that this can be done for correlation functions. For scattering amplitudes, we are still a bit unclear what scattering between what elements exactly. Because we are talking about field distributions, but there is no analog of particles here. So if one has to find an analogy with particles, then one has to sit down and build a correspondence with something inside the network, maybe the neurons or something. I'm taking a random guess, not conjecturing. But some elements of the architecture has to have a correspondence with what it means with the particles in the classical sense, and then talk about the scattering amplitudes. But in general, if I'm talking about a neural network where the fields can have two components, say psi and phi, where psi is a fermionic part and phi is a bosonic part, then I'm sure it is possible to define scattering amplitudes between psi and phi by cleverly constructing some kind of an expectation value, some kind of a statistical moment between psi and phi. It may not exactly look like a correlation function. It may be a statistical moment between a pre-final layer output along with a final layer output, something convoluted in nature, but something that we are interested in. Possible.
So I think you mentioned that you can do multiple kind of, fields in
right.
One.
That's actually the very interesting part. So it's actually ongoing work, and I did not present that part today. All right, let me check the time, and if there are no more questions, we should wrap this one up.